Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
The time that I had alone when they started going to school was only ever for me. Like, I would never clean the house, cook, go grocery shopping in the times that I was alone. The times I was alone was just for myself. And so what that meant, though, was that I had to bring them grocery shopping with me, which sometimes took twice as long or were twice as hard, or I would have to buy the toy in the cereal aisle or whatever it meant. And so sometimes grocery shopping felt harder because I had to bring them with me because I was having boundaries and protecting my own time. But they were also learning how to grocery shop.
Leslie Fandrick is an interdisciplinary artist. Her feminist practice explores how her cisgendered female body has transformed through caregiving and how home can be a fractured, fragile, and unsettling place. She curates A Red Space, an online resource for artists that features studio visits, exhibitions, and books focused on contemporary art by women and marginalized identities. And she is an adjunct faculty member at Dutchess Community College, where she teaches digital photography and drawing. In 2019, Leslie collaborated with her children at a large installation called Inflatable Room Womb for Dusklit, an outdoor interactive arts festival. She graduated in 2018 from Mass Art in Boston with an MFA and received her BFA from the Alberta College of Art and Design in Canada. She lives with her partner, Chris, in Warwick, New York. They have two kids, Milo, who is 15, and Quinn, who is 13, and a Boston Terrier named Bowie. Leslie has been a wonderful asset to our Crit Group crew mentor roster, and I'm so grateful to get to learn more about her work and her life today. Leslie, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Kaylin, thank you for having me. It's amazing to be here.
I can't wait for this conversation. Like I said, I feel like I already know you through the Crit Group program, but we've never really had a long conversation one-on-one, so it's nice to have this experience.
Yeah, me too.
All right, let's dig right in. Can you share something about your childhood that you feel like connects to your life as an artist today?
Yeah, there's two things, actually. So the first was that my mom taught me how to sew when I was probably like 8 or 9. And she used to sew her own clothes. She sewed clothing for us. And I think she taught me to sew to create like Barbie clothes for myself, like for toys. And I just found, I was looking through her old sewing box and discovered some receipts from repairs she had on her sewing machine. So I always remembered this like green sewing machine, but I finally found out what it was called and I could search for it online.
Oh,
so it was
cool.
The Elna Supramatic, and it's a Swiss made machine that you can still buy. Like it's a vintage 1950s machine.
Did you buy
one? No, I think most of them are for sale just for parts because they're not really, I don't think they make them anymore, but it was really cool to like look at it again and sort of have that like memory of being a kid. So and then my dad was he built furniture. I wouldn't call him a master craftsman. He was more of like a treasure hunter, and we would take trips to the dump, and he was always like finding things to sort of like bring home and fix. And he built this amazing desk, and my favorite part about it was this like hidey spot he had in the back of a drawer where he could like tuck his secrets, I guess. And so, you know, I think they were both very creative, but never identified at all as like artistic. But my dad also like designed and built his first house. And so all of those things, I feel like that crafty part of their lives is really an important part of my practice now.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, just how it's kind of interwoven within just them being parents, being domestic, like having a home. And but I was laughing because I just think it's so interesting that Your work is literally a combination of furniture and textiles, you know? Yeah. And I don't know, like just the combination of those two specific things that you talked about that your parents kind of brought into your home and brought an awareness and attention of you towards, you know, and obviously it makes a lot of sense to you, but just wondering about that trajectory of your work and maybe, I don't know, having arrived at the combination of those two things.
It was like unintentionally, you know, I think that it definitely for me came from just living a life, right? Like living a life in a domestic home. For my parents, it was very much about being thrifty, like sewing your own clothes and making your own furniture. It was never intentional. And in fact, when I was reflecting on this question a little bit, it wasn't the first thing I thought of, like, you know, thinking of bringing those two sort of pieces together from my mother and father, or things that are sort of like maybe more traditionally feminine or masculine, like that wasn't intentional, but but in my practice, it's been very intentional to bring together sort of like, two opposite ends of binaries, or, you know, to always be sort of integrating those things. So it was something I realized upon reflection, but you know, one of those things that like, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. And speaking of, I feel like you should describe what your work looks like for any listeners who don't know the specifics of what we're talking about.
Yeah. So I talk a lot about how my objects feel very familiar, but also very strange. They're body sized. And because of the textiles, they're very inviting. So people are often drawn in to want to touch them. But then often when they get there, they find something that's a little off-putting. And usually it has to do with a body. So like something that resembles like a breast or a penis, or something that's like, looks like veins or pimply or hairy. And so there's this like push-pull where people are sort of like seduced in. And then once they get there, they're a little bit like, oh, what's happening here? And there's a distinct sense of care, I think, involved with them as well. Like people talk a lot about wanting to take them home or care for the actual art objects, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, there's like this, well, certainly this figuration, but not quite human, almost more like a pet or...
Yeah.
I don't know, like a frumpy dog laying in the corner and you just want to, you know, like play around with it, or there's definitely this element. Like when I look at your work, I think of Beauty and the Beast and like the furniture kind of coming alive, you know, and like all of a sudden it's not a teapot. It's like a half woman, half teapot, like, you know, this weird kind of whimsical combination of personality and object that's kind of combined, which is really, really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And that subject object relationship is really important to me. It gets at ideas of abjection. Julia Kristeva's essay on the powers of horror, you know, talk about that moment that, you know, you sort of realize you're separate from your mother is a moment of like being repelled a little bit. And so the difference between who am I as a subject and as an object is really something I'm interrogating when I make the work.
Interesting. And along that line, just pushing a little further, tell me about the connection, like investigating the range of a binary. Like what is sort of your interest in discussing that within the work, and, you know, just tell me about that experience.
It took me a long time to like figure out what the root of it was. It started with this sense of like being in between things all the time. And that is, you know, I think about that a lot in terms of being from Canada, but living in the United States. I think about it in terms of, you know, feminine and masculine attributes, like what I talked about with my mom and dad. And I think eventually I began to realize that it was inherent in my sense of queerness and being mm-hmm. bisexual. And so this sense, like this in between space, is actually a really good place to be. You know, like mm-hmm. I resisted it for a long time, and trying to find comfort in that third place, mm-hmm. comfort in being both, because I think it's really valuable to be able to pull from all of the aspects and of ourselves and be really complex people. So yeah, and then it's also, you know, I think about it informally in terms of like what's hard and soft, and how can it be painting and sculpture, and mm-hmm. how can things feel still and movement, you know, like, so I think that it's actually a really dynamic place to explore in so many different ways.
Mm, I love that too. I'm just wondering too, a little bit about how motherhood is a part of this conversation, like mm-hmm. existing Absolutely. Across a spectrum within a binary, never maybe feeling like certain in one place, but just that continual mm-hmm. evolution and shifting, I feel like is just a big part of becoming a parent. And just wanting to hear you talk a little bit about, I don't know, that exploration within your work, but also like being a cisgendered woman, like raising two kids, like just kind of that connection.
Yeah. I think a lot about like how, the dynamics that are set up, right? For mothers, the good mother, or the bad mother, right? Mm-hmm. Like you're one or the other. Well, no, I'm actually kind of both. Like, you know, there's, and also what is good and bad anyway? Like, what are those things anyway? Like, it's kind of false, you know, these false ideas, or the Madonna whore, you know, mm-hmm. like, again, so there's a lot of different ways that it plays into, to my identity as a mother, but also as someone who's sexual. And I think a lot of where I got confused is this intense intimacy that you feel with your children, mm-hmm. And the crossovers, you know, like I breastfed both my kids for over a year each. And it was like altogether, you know, a 4-year period where I was either pregnant or nursing or somehow mm-hmm. like really physically involved with these babies. And remembering like having to go and nurse a baby after I had been aroused, and mm-hmm. like having to actually like throw up, you know, boundaries in my brain, because it's, you know, or, you know, like I also know of feminist artists who have allowed for that there to be like more fluidity there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's still a struggle for me. Like I'm 15 years into parenting, and I still haven't maybe fully sorted out, like, you know, the how to be a mother and a sexual woman at the same time, or maybe mm-hmm. I can't, I don't know.
There's certainly a lot of restrictions, or you know, mothers aren't allowed to feel pleasure or to be erotic or have a sex drive, you know, in our culture. A lot of the times I think that's kind of the narrative that is presented to us. So, mm-hmm. It's just such an important thing to talk about publicly too. I mean, I think of the work of Mary Kelly and, you know, like her kind of investigation between that line of like, you know, am I fetishizing like my caregiving, like my relationship with my kid, like just, I don't know that, like, I love that, just willingness to sit with the discomfort of not always having, you know, a formula for these things or a specific boundary, and really allowing it. It's interesting, like thinking of you pushing your work to have these contrasts, mm-hmm. but then while you're doing that, you yourself are trying to be a person with more fluidity and movement sort of across you know, the spectrum of being a human. It's just really lovely to think about that.
Yeah. And also, you know, what it means for being honest and truthful too, because I think a lot about also like how I teach my kids and what I'm teaching my kids, right? Like I'm raising boys and I want them to be feminist and I want them to be, you know, they're, it seems straight white men are going to be straight white men, according to now. I try to keep that open, but they're like, oh, mom, we're pretty good here.
You're like, but, you never know.
Yeah, I know. I had to stop doing that though. They were like enough. But I want them, I want to raise them with some sense of responsibility and I want to teach them. You know, I think we could talk also about like where the state of sex education is and, and you know, like kids don't get a lot of information. And so, and I've thought a lot about like, how do I educate my children, but also be respectful of, you know, the bigger conversation that's going on. And, and yeah, so there, and there's no, like, there's no right answer. There's no one way to be. And that trying to stay in that middle place is always the challenge. It's like constantly reminding myself, it's okay to not know. It's okay to not be a certain way. And it's okay to be constantly evolving and changing.
And I feel like that's such a hard, hard place to be as a parent because, you know, it's just easier to fall into the, well, yes, I have the answers because I'm the adult. And, you know, I just think about moments in my own home and in conversations with my kids and just, you know, really wanting to model like this state of ambivalence for them and like letting them be comfortable in sort of the discomfort of like not having all the answers. Like I think specifically about conversations we've had about sexuality, about religion, and just never wanting, you know, like never wanting them to, I don't know, have like such a concrete idea about things and certainly not like as young as they are.
Yeah, it's difficult to keep things open because it means you have to have a much bigger conversation and you have to include, you know, a lot more information a lot of times. But I think teaching that ability, it's also related to like researching and reading and like, no, I don't have the answer, but let's see what we can find together or let's explore this together. So it's tied in with like curiosity and it's tied in with reading and learning and research and sort of understanding that we will never know everything. And let's explore it together.
As a parent too, I think it means you have to be open to them having a different opinion than you, which is hard, you know. Or maybe supporting something that you actually do have, you know, strong feelings about. So, let's bring it back to art a little bit more, Leslie, and talk about this idea of reading and research within your practice, because I know, like, I know when you've you know, been listed on our website and stuff as a crit group mentor, you've talked about like how research and building a library and like being really intentional with the information that you're seeking out about your practice is like a big part of what you consider to be one of your strengths as a mentor. So I would love for you to just talk about that just in general with those listening and just to hear you talk about like what that really means for you to have a research practice that is sort of fueling your art making.
Yeah, I mean, I had a teacher in undergrad, a photography teacher, who told me the best thing you can build is a library. And I've taken that to heart my whole life. But I do feel like I have different libraries. And like my current library really started, you know, 6 or 7 years ago when I felt like I needed feminism, you know, like I was feeling very stuck. And so, you know, and not finding the information I needed, you know, so I went to the library and it's like, when I have a problem, what do? I go and try to find a book about it. And so the library that I've built since then, you know, started with feminism, but has included now like women artists, because when I think back to my art history that I learned, or if I get an art history textbook, women artists aren't included for the most part. And so I had to do a lot of my own investigating, research, reading to just fill in the gaps because I didn't have this knowledge. And Mira Shore talks about how feminism isn't really institutionalized knowledge. And so many women artists have to start at the beginning. Every single one of us sort of has to start at the beginning. And that's really kind of too bad and unfortunate, but there's so much out there. And so one of the reasons why it's so important for me as a mentor to be sharing the information is because it's there. Like, like let's learn from each other. And it's not something that is, you know, in the art history textbooks. So the only place you're going to find it is from conversations with other women or women artists or art historians who've done the work. And once I started like digging into that, it was like, oh my gosh, there's so much to find. And in grad school, my art history, my final art history paper was supposed to be about like it was write your own art history textbook. And I was like, oh my God. So I got out all these art history textbooks from the library. Like I had six of them and they were all relatively the same. They tell the same modernist story of straight white men. And it's, it was so frustrating and upsetting. So I wrote my paper kind of like this alternative track and had to have an even bigger stack of books, you know, to pull from and to try to connect, because it's not this separate line, right? It all connects back to the original modernist story, but it's the stuff that you don't hear about, you know, so you can learn about minimalism and the main guys who were doing the big minimalist art. And partnered with all of them were women who were dancers, who were art critics, who were creating, you know, like in tandem with men, but the women aren't, you know, they aren't canonized. They aren't written about. They're left out of the story. And so, and I know this is for women artists who are familiar with feminist art and who have been doing this research. Some of what I say is like, oh yeah, of course, like Linda Nochlin's essay, why have there been no great women artists? Like, this is the beginning, but it's where you got to start. And many, many haven't even read that one. So I kind of like good one. About it.
Oh yeah. I love that. What about too, some ways that maybe you are doing research for your practice that is not necessarily book research? Like what are some other ways that maybe you integrate, I don't know, just having a knowledge about like the art world and.
I mean, it's getting out there and seeing the work. You know, on my website, I have a Red Space, which is, you know, it's not new knowledge. It's sharing links to, I have a section for books and research, but I also have a section for studio visits, which is artists talking about their work. You know, from their own point of view. And then another section, which is like galleries and museum shows. And the shows are, you know, you see the work in its best form and you read about it through a curator or a critic's point of view. And so to me, having those two different points of view is really important, like hearing from the artists themselves, but then also hearing, you know, what the interpretation might be. And I actually feel like, you know, they're both very important. I enjoy hearing from artists directly. Like I want to know what the artist had to say about the work. A really great podcast is called Recording Artists. On the Getty website, I think Helen Molesworth, and there's only like six episodes, but what's great about it is that there's these recordings from these artists in the late 50s and 60s, like Lee Krasner and Ava Hesse. And you get to hear their voice. And like Lee Krasner didn't sound like how I thought she would, but it was even better. Like,
I know, I wish they would make more of those.
I think they are like,
oh really?
Another, yeah. I think there's another set coming out, but I'm not sure like when.
That would be amazing.
But what was great about this was it was a combination of both hearing from the artist directly and then Helen Molesworth, who's an incredible curator, brought in contemporary artists to kind of reflect on on it. And so it was this great collaboration, and, you know, a really full sense of hearing from the artist and also from a more interpreted perspective.
Right.
So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, let's talk a little bit more specifically about some of the work that you make, Leslie. I'm interested to hear you kind of walk me through like the start to finish of a piece. Like you've talked about how, you know, information and research like sort of fuels sort of your thinking space of being an artist, but mm-hmm. Interested to hear, like, I know you have mentioned that you have a collage process.
Right.
Which I don't know if I've seen collage works from you. Like, I think most of the work that I think of when I think of you is kind of the furniture based or like the fabric book based work. So just interested to have you break down like your process a little bit more and some of the ways that you are physically making work in your studio.
Yeah. So my collage practice was what I started, grad school with. So that was what I was sort of doing on my own. And it felt very integrative to me. Like I have a history of graphic design, a background in graphic design. I have a photography background, and collage was this way to kind of like, I think of it as a drawing practice, actually. Mm-hmm. It's something I do that I just love. Like, let me just cut stuff up and paste stuff together. And it mm-hmm. feels very fluid. So a lot of times that's what I'll do when I have nothing, you know, when I just want to sort of play around. And the collage process of breaking things down into parts and then building them up again is also how I think about my sculpture. And so a lot of times it'll start with, you know, walking down the street or driving around on junk night and seeing like an incredible pair of table legs, mm-hmm. you know, like it just, there's something about them that feels very alive and interesting. And so I'll bring stuff home just like my dad did into my studio. And I have less space now, so I have to be careful what I bring, but it starts there. It starts with just sort of like bringing random things into the studio that feel really interesting. And from there, I'll take them apart like I do with the collages and try to disassemble them and figuring out how far I can go before they stop looking like what they look like originally or at what point do they feel broken enough or far enough away from the original. And then I'll play. I'll like put things together. And I've got stuff that sits in my studio for years and stuff that figures itself out right away. Like, oh, that goes with that. And then the sewing and sort of like creating things that haven't been made before comes like maybe after, you know, like what does this need? This needs something to sit on top of it or, and so it's a really fluid process. And because they're pieces, they don't, sometimes they continue to be unmade and remade, figuring out like when something's done is sometimes a challenge, but it's a very like fluid kind of a thing. And yeah, it feels very collage like, and so with the fabric books, it's less about the furniture and I actually feel like now I'm making collages, but with fabric.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it's just, and I think what works well, what I'll say is that I did have to step away from the collage process because I was working with materials that were existing already, was bringing a little bit too much unintentional stuff into the work.
Mm-hmm.
And so at some point I had to sort of really separate myself from that to, you know, getting really abstract, creating my own forms. And I'm thinking a lot now about like getting photographs printed onto fabric and ways that I might, you know, get a little more intentional even with the textiles that I'm using. So
that makes a lot of sense. Tell me about the piece that I shared about in your bio, Inflatable Room, which was a collaboration with your kids.
Yeah. So that was the first like big project I did after school. And I had found a studio at a building in my town, an old elementary school building. And it was the building that my kids were taking karate in. And so we would, you know, I'd take them to karate and then I'd go be in the studio. And there was a lot of extra space in the building. There was an entire room that was available to me to just borrow. So a friend of mine, Olivia Baldwin, had created this outdoor interactive arts festival in Sugarloaf, which is next to the town I'm at the Seligman Center. And Kurt Seligman was a surrealist artist who came to the United States from Europe during the war. And so part of that like 1950s New York mm-hmm. art scene. Marcel Duchamp stayed at the Seligman Center. Like if there's a rich mm-hmm. history of artists who've been there. And so Olivia invited me to create a piece for Dusklet. And it's sort of like I hadn't ever done anything that was interactive really, mm-hmm. or even outdoors. And trying to figure out what that might be, I landed on something that I could inflate and, mm-hmm. A room that I could inflate. And so the kids were involved right from the beginning because I knew it was going to be a big enough space to have like five people in, and just working with the materials at my studio, which, you know, after karate, they would hang out with me and we'd cut plastic and they helped me sew the outside piece of it. And I really couldn't have done it without them. So mm-hmm. it was this really fun way to involve them in my process. And it was like a summer project that we did that was weird enough that they thought it was cool. You know, it wasn't like a stressful thing to help mom, because it was just kind of like fun. Yeah. And then we had it at Dusklet, and my oldest Milo was really engaged in helping people in and out of the space and sort of like being there to kind of like encourage people to come in. Mm-hmm. And it was really great to see him, you know, want to do that. And so it wasn't like something that I insisted they do. My younger son was like, you know, he would kind of like come in when he wanted. And
right.
And although he was small, so it was good to like, he scooched in when we were first inflating it to put some sandbags down so it wouldn't blow away. So yeah, you know, it was a really fun thing.
Cool space. I want to just go take a nap in there.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the hottest day of the year. And so it was really actually hot in there. but yeah, it inflates to like a 20 foot space. And when wow. you go inside, because it's round, you sort of lose any sense of scale. Like I felt both big and small inside, and people talked a lot about, because it was being constantly inflated with air, there's this sound, there's this air circulation happening. And then it would also kind of like breathe. Like every time I opened the zipper for someone to come in or out, you know, air would come out mm-hmm. and it would kind of like deflate, and then you would close it and then it would inflate again. And so
I love
had
the
this
video.
Sense of like breathing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, when I saw the wind like buffeting it and blowing it around, it reminded me of what it felt like to be pregnant and like mm-hmm. to have somebody inside you, like, you know, with those kind of movements.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. And the greatest thing was like a mom was in there with her kids. A mom was in there who was pregnant. So I was like, you know, the womb within a womb.
A womb in a womb.
Yeah. And my friend Cody told me that she went in with her mother and heard her entire birth story inside. Aww. Which was amazing. Yeah.
That's
so
awesome.
It was really a rewarding experience on all fronts, but it was really exhausting too. Like there was a level of caretaking that I had to do. Mm-hmm. There was a moment where there were people inside and this guy walked by and he banged on the outside of it. And it was like, what? So I poked my head in and I'm like, is everyone okay in here? Because it's a very sort of like serene and mm-hmm. meditative space. And to have that happening, like, was just mm-hmm. kind of bizarre. But I felt a real sense of care with everyone mm-hmm. who came in and out. And it was, I didn't anticipate actually how exhausting emotionally mm-hmm. it was going to be for me to be showing the piece. And if I ever do it again, I would like to somehow formalize that caretaking mm-hmm. experience, because it just happened. So the caring of it was really fascinating to me.
Awesome. I love, you know, experiences of large work like that, where things come up that you just did not you know, quite expect, that you couldn't prepare for emotionally. Artist mothers know there's nothing more important than taking care of yourself, because if you're not feeling your best, you can't be your best. Sambucol helps you feel your best with powerful immune support, powered by nature's superfruit, black elderberry. I'm personally so grateful for Sambucol and their immune system supporting products. I think about my health a lot and feel like the best action I can take besides getting good sleep is nourishing my body by consuming healthy things that support my immune system. Sambucol elderberry gummies taste great, and I love that they are low in sugar and contain no gelatin since my family is vegetarian. It's so easy to get my kiddos to eat one of these gummies every day, and it helps me feel good knowing my kids have the support from products like this, especially in a season of life where reinforcing our bodies with healthy things is just on our minds a lot. Sambucol is a trusted brand. It's the original black elderberry and was developed by a virologist, so I know I'm getting a great quality product. Get 15% off your next order of $9.99 or more at sambucolusa.com. Use code ARTIST15 for 15% off. Just as a note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Thank you, Sambucol, for supporting the Artist Mother podcast. We so appreciate you and the products you're putting into the world. Again, Artist Mothers get 15% off your next order of $9.99 or more at sambucolusa.com and use code ARTIST15 for 15% off. Leslie, you recently gave a talk on our network about going back to school at age 40 with young kids. I think you titled it Getting Your MFA at 40.
Taking up space.
Taking up space. An MFA at 40, yes. such a good title. Just wanting you to talk a little bit about that experience here for those listening who maybe aren't on the network and haven't heard that part of your story, just because, because so many of us, we feel behind, we feel, if we didn't decide we were going to be an artist at age 5 and commit to that path and then go to undergrad and go to art school and do all the things and establish our career before we had kids, you just feel like you're doing things out of order, like you've done something wrong or you're behind even people who, who did all that, they still have those feelings about something else that somebody's done. So I know that's just part of the artist narrative, is a little bit of this scarcity mindset of I'm never quite doing this right. But I do think very specifically this conversation about grad school and motherhood is a really important one for people to hear about, because I think, a lot of people just kind of think it's impossible. Or maybe just it's not needed for them, which is certainly the case for a lot of people, but I want to hear you talk about this, and share sort of your thoughts and your story of going back to school.
Yeah. So first of all, there's no one way to do things. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important, for anyone who feels behind, that it's never too late. It's always time to learn more, do more, or whatever. For me, it was kind of unexpected. I didn't think I was going to do this. I had been spending a number of years sort of trying to establish my art career and had gained some success. I was showing collages, I was selling collages. I had, a few solo shows, and it felt really good. And what happened for me, I think, was that I was pushing into doing more leadership stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was feeling really scared and nervous all the time. And I had a conversation with someone who was mentoring me at the time. And she said, she was like, well, what are you missing? And I'm like, I just don't feel like I know enough. I don't feel like I know enough about feminism. I don't feel like I know enough about contemporary art. I just don't feel like I'm enough, basically. Mm-hmm. And she was like, so go back to school, like go mm-hmm. learn some more. Mm-hmm. And I was like, can I do that? And her husband had been, had gone to a low residency program in Vermont. And I didn't know about low residency programs. Mm-hmm. And so when I learned about them, it suddenly felt like, oh, maybe this is possible for me, because mm-hmm. the idea of going to school full time wasn't realistic. We live, you know, an hour and a half outside of New York City. We'd have to move. Mm-hmm. Like, it just didn't make a lot of sense. But the low residency option felt like, oh, the part that I have to be away is in the summer when the kids aren't in school.
Right.
And the family dynamic is very different. And so, all I needed was that little bit of like, it's that tiny little bit of, it might be possible mm-hmm. for me to start considering it. And as soon as I started considering it, I knew it was something I needed to do, because I got so excited. I was mm-hmm. like, what? I can go back to art school. Like, that was the favorite time of my life, was the 4 years I spent in art school. I dream yeah. about it constantly. I can do that again. Like, I can be in that environment again. I can be a student again. I can learn again. Mm-hmm. And I just really wanted it so badly. And you know, I talked with my partner and he was like, well, how are we going to do this? Like, and I said, I don't know. Like, I have no idea. Can I just try? Can I just apply and see if I even get in?
And how old were your kids at the time?
They were, I think 8 and 10, okay. you know, or like 7 and 9, right around there. And
did you have a full-time job at that time?
No, I didn't. No,
okay. I would have to give up a full-time job to make this happen, or like you were already kind of existing in
like
a space where you weren't relying necessarily on your income.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there was some room for that for sure. I mean, my full-time job had been stay-at-home mom, and mm-hmm. I was doing freelance design and photography, web design work, but it wasn't, you know, consistent. Mm-hmm. So there was a little space for that, but yeah, the childcare part was big and the financial part was big. Mm-hmm. And I applied and did get in, and then it was like, okay, now how are we going to finagle this? And for me, it was, you know, I was impatient. I could have done a little more research to maybe find a full ride program, but I also hadn't been working as an artist long enough, and I just really wanted to do it now. And so
I don't think there are a lot of scholarship opportunities for low res programs.
Yeah, that too.
Because I also did a low res program, and I mean, I too could have done more research, but it's not like getting into UT and you know, whatever. Like there's this, I mean, I think that's part of the way the structure is working, because
right.
you know, it's people, older people maybe, who have some sort of like financial stability, who can pay a little bit more, or mm-hmm. I don't know, like, which is not to say that there probably are great scholarships for people out there, so don't feel discouraged by that if that's what you need. But I just personally found that it was not like going to undergrad where there's just all of this
right.
financial aid and like scholarship structure. It's much more like, yeah, you can take out a federal loan, but you're going to pay for it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Which is what I did. There were a lot of teachers in the program. Actually, I was sort of surprised, like a lot of teachers mm-hmm. Who were coming to receive that accreditation, you know, mm-hmm. to take their career up and to the next level. But that also taught me too, through the process of like wanting to develop myself and my artwork, that teaching was something that I might be good at. You mm-hmm. know, like I had people just constantly saying to me, so are you going to teach after school? And I was like, I don't know, maybe. Mm-hmm. And now that I am, it's just so rewarding and amazing. Like the ability for me to use this master's degree to then be able to teach in a college. Mm-hmm. And then also have that credibility to mentor has been so amazing for me. Like, mm-hmm. I couldn't even believe that, like, when my dad told me as a kid, you know, you should be a teacher or a nurse. Like, now I am. Yeah. Dad, I'm a teacher. So yeah, and school was incredible. It was really, really incredible. But it did require a lot of hard stuff, you know, mm-hmm. like I had to leave the kids for 2 months, and we saw each other in between and we stayed in touch. But
you know, so your program was that it was summer focused and you would go to Boston for like 8 weeks in the summer. Is that kind of how yeah. it was structured? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. 3 summers in a row. And, you know, originally I had applied to Bard, which is a little closer. It felt mm-hmm. like a little more doable, but it's competitive and I didn't get in there. But mm-hmm. But MassArt was a very similar structure. And so, okay. yeah, the first
And there, summer, there are other low-res programs too, just, you know, yeah. because talking about the structure that, like, because I actually thought about applying to MICA. Because mm-hmm. they have a low-res program. But for me at the time, I had a 3-year-old and that was it. And just, I couldn't take the thought of like being apart from him for 6 weeks. Now, I think if like now, you know, that my kids are a little bit older or having an 8 or 10-year-old, like I can yeah. see how that summer structure would have been fine because you can like make a trip halfway in between and go visit them and like, it's fine.
Yeah.
But so I did a program where twice a year. So in January and then June, you went for like a really intense residency of like 12 days rather right. than combining it all in like the summer. Mm-hmm. And then they had, you know, a virtual structure, like you had to have a mentor in your own area who worked with you like throughout the semester and stuff. So
yeah, we did that mentoring as well. But yeah, there are other low res programs that have a bit of a different mm-hmm. push pull. But what I did love about it was that difference between having a mentor when you were at home and that mm-hmm. sort of like one-on-one private, like I'm doing this sort of alone kind of a process, mm-hmm. but then having this other thing where you would go and be in community. And then it was this other bigger expansive thing. So mm-hmm. going back and forth between those things was actually yeah. really good for me. It's not a good structure for everybody. Like I think sometimes people need that community all the time. Mm-hmm. But for me, I was pretty self-motivated being an older artist. I was like, I don't have any time or money to spare. Like I got to get right. as much done while I'm in here as I can.
Yeah. I think the benefit of that too, is that you're not completely disassociating from your normal life.
Right.
Right. Like you are forced to consider like the ways that your art career is integrated within your life rather than like, I'm just going to go and spend a year and do this thing completely separate from the right. rest of, you know, my journey as an artist. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And having the kids, you know, be older and be able to see me do this thing was mm-hmm. like also such a great part of it, you know, like what a great way to teach them about how to go to school mm-hmm. other than like going to school, you know, like I got to study. I have a paper to write, you know? And so the things that I think they learned, I mean, they were amazing on the tour that we got, like to see for a little while, my son thought he wanted to be a sculpture major, like seeing the welding shop, which just blew his mind, the glass mm-hmm. blowing studio. And then to have them in a college environment visiting mm-hmm. just to see that was really great. And then I graduated, like I did it, you know?
Yeah.
And so that level of accomplishment, I think witnessing, you know, I talk a lot about modeling behavior for your kids and what a great way to do that. So. Mm.
Speaking yeah. of, let's talk a little bit about, just what it means as an artist mother to take up space in your family life, in your own life, in your finances. I yeah. know, you know, that this is something that you've thought a lot about, and grad school is a part of your journey of saying like, I am going to take up this space within our family and it will be fine. But just wanting to hear you talk about maybe some other ways that you have processed, you know, taking up space for your art practice and maybe not seeing it as, you know, in contrast to everything else that you want to do as a human being. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, when it started, it was really simple. Like, I wanted a space with a door that I could close, that I could leave a mess, that nobody would go in and do anything with, that it was just sort of mine. And so that beginning place was like, this is making some place in the house. Like, this is my studio, and my kids still share a bedroom. Like, so that's one of the consequences. Like, my boys have always shared a bedroom, and they always will. And I think that's good, because one day they get to college and they're going to have a dorm room. So, so, you know, understanding that, like, I can take this space for me and everything's going to be okay. They can share and we can figure things out. The other thing too was, like, the time that I had alone when they started going to school was only ever for me. Like, I would never clean the house, cook, go grocery shopping in the times that I was alone. The times I was alone was just for myself. And so what that meant, though, was that going grocery I had to bring them grocery shopping with me, which sometimes took twice as long or were twice as hard, or I would have to buy the toy in the cereal aisle or whatever it meant. But, and so sometimes grocery shopping felt harder because I had to bring them with me because I was having boundaries and protecting my own time, but they were also learning how to grocery shop. And, you know, like, so the chores that I did, I tried to always do with them. I haven't done that enough. I think I need to teach them to cook a little more, you know, but so it's harder to sometimes, like, I think it's easier sometimes for women to just do it all themselves or to take that alone time to get done all that stuff that they've been meaning to do. It's harder to do those things with the kids, but I think it's really, really important.
Well, I think that's such an important point too, for artists who maybe have been stay-at-home moms or, like, who are in a partnership where one of them, like, is works from home or is home more, because, you know, you wouldn't have those expectations on, like, neighbors who both work out of the home, right? Like, family, domestic life and family duties are all are completed outside of those 8 to 5 hours or whatever where people are working. And so I do think, I just want to, like, bring that point, you know, to focus, because I know there's so many artist mothers who listen, who struggle with the guilt of, like, you know, I have to do, I have to make sure my home is clean and all of our meals are prepped. And, like, I don't know, just having all of that in line before they, like, prioritize their art. And and it just, it doesn't have to be that way, right?
Like, no, it doesn't,
And just because you've set up this structure with your partner that you are the stay-at-home mom, like doesn't mean that, you know, you, I don't know, just, like.
Well, one thing I did, Kaylin, I insisted on there being hours that I was working, even though I wasn't the one who was making any money at the work I was doing. I insisted at a certain point with my partner, I'm like, I know you have the 9-to-5 job and the majority of our income is coming from you, but I also have a job and it's to be an artist, and I might not have as many hours, but I still need hours. And even though those aren't hours I'm getting paid anything, like, that's still my job. And so I insisted on sort of reframing how, what my work was, and, like, this is unpaid work that I'm doing, but it's just as valuable. And so creating value that isn't monetary, it's valuable for me to be moving my career forward so that one day I maybe get paid, but also valuable just in terms of my own mental health and ability to feel like a creative person who's, who's making something in the world. And that's not always an easy thing. You know, you really need to have a supportive partner who listens and who can understand that this is important.
Yeah. And I think too, that conversation, like, it really does come down to what you value. I, like, and I know like this is a privileged conversation because lots of people have to work to like make ends yes. meet or support themselves. And, but I still think there's this, it's just so easy in our culture to make everything about money.
Yeah.
And it's just funny because I know so many amazing people, artists, mothers, who they just can't let go of that. But these hours aren't equaling monetary value. Right. And I just want to say, like, but is money what you value most? Like,
right.
because mm-hmm. the way that you're framing that is that my time is not valuable. This thing I'm not doing is not valuable unless I'm making money from it. But then you're also going to, at a different point in conversation with me, say, you know, that you value freedom, that you value rest, that you've, you know, like, so how yeah. are we, like, it's just,
yeah. well, it's we, hard, live in a like that part. We live in a capitalist society, you know,
I know
we get messages from everywhere that the mm-hmm. only value is money. But yeah, I think that there are absolutely other ways to value things. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, honestly, I stopped valuing a really tidy house, and I stopped valuing, like, we have a meal service, you know, mm-hmm. like we shifted some things so that mm-hmm. I could do less. And it was me insisting mm-hmm. on doing less, you know, nobody was saying do less.
Mm-hmm. And like you brought up too, at the beginning of this conversation, I think it's better to have your kids involved in this stuff anyway. Like, I know it's not yeah. easier a lot no. of the time. And like, no. you know, you taking time to do stuff on your own, like, yeah, there are always moments where I actually don't mind putting on a podcast and doing the laundry down in the basement by myself. But
yeah.
like, I don't know, just, you know, I want my kids to be raised to know how to do these things on their yes. own. I don't want them to like go to college or go out in the world and their mom yeah. has done every single thing for them or their parents, you know, like,
yeah,
like they're yeah. they empty the dishwasher and they're going to start mowing the lawn and, you know, like yeah. just like,
yeah. And my kids do their own laundry too. And yeah. you know, they don't sort it and they hardly fold it. And it sits in a,
shirts are wrinkled. It's fine.
Yeah. It's just, that's the way they're going to do their laundry. So yeah. I mean, letting that stuff happen means, yeah. you know, I have to let go of a lot of stuff too. But that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Leslie, what does caring for yourself sort of look like in the structure of your home and your family? Just cause we're kind of talking about this time and
yeah.
how you spend it. I mean, I think just being good with your boundaries about your artist life, I'm sure is like an easy answer for you, but are there other ways that you like, are there other things that you sort of need, and that you really have to be intentional about, carving out time or space for?
Yeah. I mean, wasn't able to do this for a long time because I had little kids, but now that they're bigger, I try to take care of my needs first mm-hmm. before they need stuff. And so mm-hmm. what that looks like for me, that is completely opposite from the way that I used to be, is I go to bed early and I mm-hmm. get up early. And I try to have time in the morning, to write my morning pages and to have mm-hmm. my coffee when it's quiet and nobody's around to like need stuff. So, you know, that, you know, put your face mask on first before you put mm-hmm. on your kids is really important. But I wasn't able to do that for a long time. I mean, with little babies, it's like mm-hmm. you're just on 24 hours all the time. And so that's one thing that changes is as they got older, I was able to start making sure that I was taken care of first. Mm-hmm. So that when they needed taking care of, I could be 100% present. For them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's looked a lot like sometimes not cooking dinner, mm-hmm. Or going to, you know, laying down for a nap if I need one after mm-hmm. teaching for 5 hours, or saying to them like, the door's closed, you know, mom's done at 8 o'clock tonight. Like if you need anything, you're on your own. Mm-hmm. And so taking care of myself is often about encouraging them to take care of themselves.
That's what I was just going to say was like, I feel like you're
yeah.
just enabling them to learn how to care for themselves too
yeah.
and modeling that for them. which is important.
And sometimes even taking care of me, like, you know, the joke around our house is that I'll sit on the couch and like ask for somebody to bring me something or, you know, like they're teenagers now. And I'm like, listen, I put a lot of hours in like years ago and now it's paid off.
You can make me a cup of tea.
Yeah. So, and not feeling bad about it and knowing that like, you know, I'm not being selfish or demanding. Mm-hmm. I'm teaching them. That's, you know, teaching them. And, you know, saying no to things also, like, I try to make sure that when I am saying yes, it's because I want to, not because I have to. And sometimes that means just a reframe for me. Like, you know, if there's something I'm like, oh, this is something I have to do. Sometimes I try to consider like, how can I reframe that into something? No, this is what I want to do. Like right now I want to be playing Mortal Kombat with my youngest son because he needs me to be present with him in his space. And so, you know, that.
Are you good at Mortal Kombat?
No, I'm terrible. They call me a button pusher. I'm just button pushing. But I, you know, I said, I'm like, I didn't grow up playing Mortal Kombat. I grew up playing Tekken, which is like Japanese martial arts. It's not as gory.
Yes.
Mortal Kombat is disgusting. But
I love it. Just a couple more questions, Leslie, and then we'll wrap up. Just curious to hear if there's a piece of advice that you've been given that has really influenced you. I always think this is like an interesting question just to kind of think about, like, what are some of the words that have really stuck with you over time and that have maybe become like personal mantras?
Yeah. The most shocking for me was that from my seminar teacher in grad school, I think I walked in late one day and I apologized. And he was like, he looked at me and he's like, stop apologizing all the time. And he said, I've done 10 things this morning that that I should have apologized for and I didn't. And I've thought a lot about it. Like, first of all, I'm Canadian, so it's like in my DNA. Like, I apologize when people get in my way. Like, it's ridiculous. but I think that it's also related to like it's not a confident position, you know, like being self-deprecating or coming from some type of an apologetic point of view. Like, it isn't always as confident and certain of things as I want to be. And so, so I think about it in terms of like, just how I am in the world. Like, and that is related to taking up space. Like, I'm not going to apologize for needing space or time or anything. Like, this is just what I need. And that's okay. So I think to stop apologizing is really important for Canadians, but also women.
Tell me a little bit about being Canadian and living in the US. You grew up in Canada all the way through college.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so you've lived your adult life in the US.
Yeah.
Is that right?
I just passed the halfway mark between time spent in Canada and time spent in the United States. So okay. I'm 46 and I left Canada when I was 23.
Okay.
And I felt a sense of grief, actually. Like, up until then I had felt like I'd spent more time in Canada. I was maybe a little more Canadian and now I'm a little more American. But it gets back to that third place that, you know, I can see things differently. Like, I come from an outsider point of view and I'm often in an outsider headspace. And I think that that's an okay place to be. And so, you know, but also that apologetic, friendly, and everyone's like, oh, you're so friendly. And I'm like, yeah, I'm from Canada.
Yeah.
and then anytime I meet somebody who's also Canadian, like, just automatic 10 points and best friends. Like, we're, you know, it's just going to be bring my people to me.
I love it. What about the art world? Like, just, you know, I know you were a student, so like you didn't live as a professional artist in Canada, but I'm interested just to hear you talk maybe about some, I don't know, like, what are like the different feelings about the art world in the US versus Canada? Or, you know,
I mean, there's a couple things that come into play. There's a gallery owner that I met in New York who is also from Canada, and I talked a little bit with her about, I'm like, what's the contemporary art scene there like? And she was somewhat dismissive, which was sort of made me sad. I think there's definitely an art culture in Canada. It isn't as capitalist, mm-hmm. perhaps. And there's also, there's just like a different lifestyle in Canada. People are like a little more easygoing and a little more relaxed and, mm-hmm. And tend to like enjoy their life more. Like they'll go for a hike. And so, I don't know, it's just a different mind frame. Mm-hmm. It's a little more intense down here and people are a little bit more like aggressively pursuing whatever it is that they're pursuing, which is good. And I think to have both is really, really important. Mm. But I did get a book called Desire Change about feminist art happening in Canada. And I think that there's a lot of that going on like under the radar. Mm. And there's also a lot of amazing Indigenous art, the contemporary Indigenous art. And so mm-hmm. the art culture is reckoning with some of those type of cultural things that are way more prevalent in Canada, like in terms of the Indigenous culture and reconciling with the history and the past of that. Mm. So it's an area that I actually need to do a little more reading and research about.
There you go. You know how to do that. All right, Leslie, always like to close with five final questions for us to get to know you a little bit better. Number yes. one, who's your biggest art crush?
Sarah Lucas. Mm-hmm. She's a YBA, I think, the young British artist, part of that like scene. Mm-hmm. But I saw her show at the New Museum in 2018. It just blew my mind. She is like so badass, just totally irreverent and like funny and like sexy, but also vulgar. She's got a piece called Bunny Gets Snookered. It's like this giant pool table with all of these chairs and these like floppy figures made out of nylons. Mm. And it's all about the body and, mm-hmm. And just, I love it. Just
so like installation, cool. textile based artists.
Yeah, like yeah. everything. I mean, yeah. photography, she's got video stuff. She had an entire wall that was just people had thrown eggs at it. It was just egg yolks dripping down. So like, you know, a car covered in cigarettes. Like she just, it's just inventive and, wow. and amazing. Yeah, love her.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, what is your favorite place to travel or a dream trip that you'd like to go on?
So obviously I traveled back to Canada a lot, although I haven't been there in a couple of years. But my dream actually is to rent an RV and drive from New York State all the way around the United States, like hitting all the art museums and art stops along the way, going to like the Terrell crater and then all the way through New Mexico, going to visit Judy Chicago, see the Grand Canyon, all the national parks, all the way up the California coast into Canada. And then I'm going to end up at my parents' storage unit, which I still have to clear out. I'm going to pack the RV with all their stuff and junk and then drive back to New York. You know, through Chicago and Minneapolis and all of that. So,
oh, well, I think you should make that happen.
I want to. I really do. It's going to happen.
Okay. What is a book or a film that is just at the top of your inspiration list?
So Mira Shore, her book Wet, it's called On Painting, Feminism and Art Culture. And it is incredible. There's so many good essays in it. One is called From Liberation to Lack. There's another one about patrilineage. So like how women artists should separate themselves from this male hierarchy and mm-hmm. really establish a matrilineal, mm-hmm. you know, artist hierarchy, which starts a lot of times with Louise Bourgeois. I mean, let's yep. get her in there. So yeah, Mira Shore's Wet is amazing. And the one other one, it's called Inappropriate Bodies, mm-hmm. Art, Design, and Motherhood. And there's so much amazing stuff in there that really made sense to me.
By Rachel, what is her last name?
Rachel Epp Bueller.
Yeah. Bueller. Yeah. I was going to say Butler, but yeah, Bueller. I know. I got to get Rachel on the podcast. I've met her before.
Great.
Yeah. She's great. Good ones. Okay. What's your favorite meal?
I got to admit, I love a good ribeye steak and a romaine salad with it.
I always like anticipate what people are going to say for that one. Cause I don't know. It's just like, I feel like you get to know the person a little, you know, like,
yeah.
favorite meal.
Did you peg me as like a steak girl? Or
I thought you were going to say a bowl of pasta, but you know.
Well, I could also go with like popcorn and wine for dinner. Like I love popcorn.
Do you put M&Ms in your popcorn?
No, but my partner does. And I think it's kind of odd, but you know, if that's what you enjoy.
Well, I love the like salty sweet combination. Peanut M&Ms are my favorite, but it's funny. I had really good friends growing up in high school who they were from Canada. And whenever we went to their house, they like, that's what their mom would make us was like these big bowls of popcorn. And so we always called it Canadian popcorn, like, which I knew it wasn't like a Canadian thing necessarily, but I don't know. Yeah. There's like that association is just kind of funny for me.
Oh, that's great. I'll have to remember that.
Yeah, it's good. Okay. And finally, just like to offer you a space to give a shout out to someone who supports you in your work.
So I could go on and on. And I would just want to say a blanket shout out to my partner for everything, you know, undeniably supportive. I already mentioned Olivia Baldwin, who did Dusklit. She's such a dear art friend of mine, and so many opportunities have come through my friendship with her. But the person I really want to shout out to is Milo, my son. Mm. He's 15, and I call him my art buddy. He helped me pack up my studio. I don't know how many times. Quinn and my partner Chris have as well. But Milo one time helped me pack up my studio in Newburgh, and we drove to Boston together. And he helped me set up my studio there at grad school. We stayed overnight, and then we came back. And he's like always up for like an hour car drive to go see a museum, or he's helped me install shows, deinstall shows. Like he's taller than me now, and he's bigger. So he's a real big muscle help for sure. Yeah. But also just so pleasant to like have along and be with me, and willing to sort of like come and be with me in the space that I need to. So big shout out to Milo, my art buddy, and my other son, Quinn, just so he doesn't get jealous. He's my cuddle buddy. So he reminds me of why I like to come home.
I love that. Oh, they sound like really sweet kids.
They're great. Yeah.
Okay, Leslie, where can people find out more about you and your work?
Yeah. So my website is my name, LeslieFandrick.com. I'm on Instagram at the same thing, at Leslie Fandrick. And would love to hear from anyone who has any other questions or comments. I'm always up for conversation.
Awesome. And hopefully in the future, you can possibly work with Leslie in our group crew program, though. Yay, she's already booked up for this time. So you'll have to catch her next time.
Next time.
Thank you so much, Leslie. This has been great. And thank you, Kaylin. I can't wait to publish this episode.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a great day. We'll talk to you soon.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.